Real quick though, what is your accent? Are you you're Scottish?
No, I'm English. We live near Manchester in England, northwest of England.
I've worked with a lot of English folks in New York when I was in the news business, and I have like an idea. I know that there's a whole lot of different accents, but I could never quite keep them straight.
Daphne on Frasier, she tries to adapt.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Forgot about her.
That's an approximation of our accent, I think. Mm. When I think of New Jersey, all I think of is Springsteen. So I just assume that you live on a boardwalk somewhere and go bar to bar listening to bands. Is that not the case? No?
No. The boardwalk's actually about an hour away, just right outside New York. So it's just a sort of swampy industrial town.
Yeah, Springsteen and the Sopranos, that's the...
Oh, the Sopranos was filmed in town, so that is much more accurate. Do you remember in the titles, Pizzaland?
Oh yeah, yeah.
It's literally two blocks away from me, around the corner.
Brilliant.
We had Pizzaland pizza for dinner on Saturday.
Have you seen me dice bag?
Grognard Files.
Hello, my name is Dirt the Dice, and this is the Grognard Files podcast, where we talk bobbins about tabletop RPGs from back in the day and today. I'm coming live from my den here in the heart of the northwest of England. I'm completely and utterly surrounded by my stuff. On my right is the great library of RPGs and my Grognard Files. Following the interview last time with Paul Badowski, I've fallen down a bit of a D-sanction rabbit hole. I'm about to run a scenario set in the County of Lancaster for the one-shot club that we run for patrons. I've been buying books recommended by the rulebook and watching A Discovery of Witches. And now I know more about this era than I ever have done before. My den now favours the library of Dee himself, the largest known in England. On my left is the ridiculous homemade shrine to the actor Caroline Munro. I'll just give it a tap. Ah yes, the eternal champion has appeared once again as Carla, who dared to dance on the Sabbath, in Captain Kronos, Vampire Hunter. Kronos has recently had a recent re-release at the cinema with a digitally restored print. I'm looking forward to picking up the Blu-ray release. But that's not why she's appeared here. She's appeared as Carla because this time we're talking about magic. In the Zoom of Roleplaying Rambling, I'm joined by Stu Hovarth, the co-host of Vintage RPG Podcast, and the author of an incredible book about role-playing games through the decades, titled Monsters, Aliens and Holes in the Ground. You may remember that I attended a symposium last year about RPGs and Stu was a speaker. He made the comment that RPGs are immune to analysis because ultimately they're experienced personally. We discuss that further here. We also cover a wide range of topics, including Stu's views on magic. Judge Blythe, our resident rules lawyer, joins me in the attic to look at our gaming shelves. Regular listeners will know that now and again we like to take some games off the shelf and decide if we should play them, keep them for reference, or get rid of them. This time we're focusing our attention on magic systems. Which ones do we want to play, stay, or give away? It's a big subject, and we can't possibly give it justice, but we have a go, basing it on some of our current thinking around the topic. We've covered it before, but it's one of those topics that it's worth going back to. What do you look for in a magic system? Do you like having access to spells in a game? I asked these questions to the GrogPod Discord, and there were some insightful responses, which you can see on the Grod Production channel, where I usually give an update on upcoming episodes that we're working on. We were directed towards Ars Magica, which I've never played, but love to explore. And there were some more general comments. I like this from Arcane, aka Angus, who presented a thesis for Gaming Magic, which I referred to a couple of times during the podcast. He has a list of pertinent observations, but this is the central idea. There are two types of magic, slow and fast. Fast is for combat or action and is essentially buffs and debuffs for us and for them, and slow is for summoning, rituals, cursing, etc. Fast and slow magic, and that's what we'll be casting here. Ramblers, let's get rambling. Open box!
Welcome to the Zoom of Roleplaying Rambling, where I'm joined by podcaster, founder of Unwinnable, collector and writer of Monsters, Aliens and Holes in the Ground, a guide to tabletop roleplaying games from D&D to Mothership. Live from the swamps of New Jersey, it's Stu Hovarth. Hello there, Stu.
Hello, thank you so much for having me on.
I've been meaning to ask you for quite a while. I feel that we're fellow travellers in the world of vintage RPGs.
Absolutely. And podcasting.
Where did you start in the hobby? What, just take us back to those heady days.
I was really fascinated with what I saw of D&D sort of through the cartoon and seeing the books and such in bookstores, but my mom wouldn't let me have it. She wasn't because of the satanic panic stuff. So this was around 1984, I guess. And then I eventually convinced my grandmother to buy the blue expert box from the mall one day. And also like X10, I think, which is actually not a module at all. It's a strategy. It's like a battle system, which is ironic considering how much I hate battle system now. But those were my two first things. And it was just like I eventually got the basic box, the famous Elmar cover. I spent most of fourth grade making, dungeon maps when I should have been paying attention to math. And it's been all downhill from there.
So who were you playing with at the time?
It took a long time before I could get a group. My friends at the time had older brothers who were playing, but they wouldn't really let us play. And we had a really poor notion of how the game was supposed to work. It was a couple of years later when we got the Marvel Superheroes game that things sort of gelled, because we sort of understood how superheroes work because we were getting into the comic books at the time too. So that sort of the way that, conflict happened in comic books helped us sort of figure out conflict in the game. And we were able to sort of play something that was similar to the games, the rules as published. And then we got into D&D, like in seventh and eighth grade, I found like a group of guys who are for the most part, still in my group. So lifelong friendships forged through Dungeons and Dragons.
It's curious, isn't it, that I speak to lots of people that had to have that experience of finding their way through the game, just trying to understand how it worked.
They just did a terrible job, explaining what the game was in the early days. And I think that it took 40 years before they really figured it out. And I still don't think that there's that great at, there's not a big pile of good examples of, introductory material out there still. There's more. It's more friendly, but it's still really hard to like get that initial sort of comprehension of what the game is across to somebody who has no context for it at all. My mom has been watching me play, for years. She's read the book. She still doesn't really get it. It's really funny.
You said Marvel Superheroes. What were the other games that were in your repertoire?
Almost immediately after Marvel and D&D, got into Call of Cthulhu, which might be my most run game as a game master. We played some Paranoia, and we tried Pendragon and made a mess of that. And the Star Wars role-playing game was a fixture on and off for probably close to a decade. GURPS. That's probably the lion's share of it in the early days, anyway.
So with GURPS, was it a case of, did you use it as a generic system or was it just supporting fantasy games?
Oh, no, it was. I think that our longest running game was a Supers game, oddly enough. But we played a weird horror Western game for a while. There were a couple different configurations of generic rule modular rules use that was really fun. Because we had D&D and we had Star Wars, the
those kinds of experiences were already sort of mapped out in rules. So we used GURPS to do what we couldn't do elsewhere.
It's funny. People, when I was writing the book, people were like, GURPS is really hard. I was like, really? And they're just like, there's so much math. I was like, I hate math. And I still love GURPS.
But I think that I hit it right at, you know, the right time. You know, we had time and energy and patience to sort of teach each other how to play the game. So that I just, if you gave me GURPS now, I probably would bounce right off it. Even knowing what I know of it, I don't think I really want to play GURPS in this day and age. I have a smaller appetite for or tolerance for crunch.
I think we've discovered that as well, going back to some of those games that we loved and returning to something like Dragon Quest, for example, and realizing that we never actually played it as it was meant to be played. We kind of concocted our own version of it.
Well, I'm not even sure. You know, I played just about every, you know, flavor of Dungeons & Dragons, but I'm running West March's game for my patrons using BX, OSE. We're really using rules as written, and it's amazing because I think that I love first and second edition AD&D, but I don't think we ever played it right. There's whole sections of rules. I feel like we always, you know, hacked it so that it was more like BX than AD&D. It's very, really eye-opening to see what we could sort of let ourselves get away with as kids and then I took those assumptions and applied them to D&D like as if that was the actual D&D. Like I'm a little scared to reread the book because I feel like I might have gotten a couple things wrong just because of sort of youthful indiscretions with the rules.
Did you ever stop playing or did you continue playing?
I've played very little. I've run almost, I'm you know, like the forever GM. But I did, there was a period of time, but very short, really. I feel like most people, like they hit college and then maybe like for 10 years or 15 years, they drop off. I hit college and I still played. It was sort of right after college when career stuff started to like become a focus that I took like 4 or 5 years off. But it was always on the radar. It was never like it never fell off completely, I don't think.
Because I'm curious, because you're now a collector, aren't you? You what inspires that drive? Is it to get stuff that you didn't have when you were younger, or to fill in gaps, or is it something else?
It's a combination of both those things, I think. A lot of stuff got lost in a flood, which is a story that I hear over and over again. People stored their role-playing books in the basement, and then there was too much rain, and you know that box got wet and thrown out. That's exactly what happened to a lot of my stuff. I lost some stuff. Some stuff was lent out, never came back to me. And I got to a point where I did want that stuff back. But also, and I'd always been fascinated with stuff that was in Dragon Magazine, you know, the advertisements of stuff that like I never saw in real life, because you know I didn't have a game store really locally. It was a bookstore that always had some role playing stuff, but not like not like tons. Didn't get to go into like the city to the complete strategist or anything like that. So I was basically stuck with what I could find, you know, there in the comic book store. So I was always fascinated with the stuff that was in Dragon Magazine advertisements that I couldn't find, but then the internet. Oh, like I just one day I was just like, wonder what else Chaosium made, because I just didn't know. And I started looking and I found all of those wonderful box sets that I just never had seen before. And it was just I love Chaosium's products. I love their product design, aside of just the role playing game. I just think that they look good. Their aesthetic kind of clicks in my brain in a really appealing way. And I just needed all of those 1-inch boxes. And as I started researching, it's just like there's a strong aesthetic pull that I feel for role playing games made between 74 and like 93, 94. And that just the Chaosium drove it. But then I was buying other stuff and finding new stuff, and I just it spiraled out of control. And now I have far, far too many role-playing game books.
Box sets, because you do make that point, actually, in your book, that mm-hmm. the appeal of the box set is enduring.
I love a box set. I know a lot of people who hate box sets and slipcases, and I think they're monsters. I love, there's so much promise in a box. And that might just be because my first role-playing product was a box. But box sets over anything else. Like if I had to get rid of everything, I would keep the box sets.
One of my go-to resources since starting the Grognard Files has been Lawrence Stick's Heroic Worlds, A History and Guide to Role-Playing Games. Do you know that book?
Oh my God, I love that book. I love it so much. Me and my future wife, 11 years ago or 10 years ago, our apartment was burgled in Jersey City. It was horrible. And my friend Brian Taylor, inspired by like how crappy that was, sent me a care box, a box of books. And in it was Heroic Worlds, and just a fantastic book. And like, as much as, you know, there are a bunch of factors as to why the book came about, but I think that I don't think that the book would have really manifested in the way that it did if it wasn't for Heroic Worlds. The book's amazing.
Yeah, it's one of those books that you can't avoid dipping into. You end up going on a little rabbit hole. It's like the entire internet in one book. And I'm pleased to say that your book kind of supplanted it as my go-to book to dip into. It's like an endless resource.
Oh, that's extremely complimentary. I don't know how to respond to that.
it's great. I just find myself dipping into it for hours and then doing as a consequence, going on the internet, hunting down things that I haven't got. So,
yeah, that's, I get complaints about that. I mean, loving complaints, but nevertheless, between my Instagram feed, the book, and the podcast, I think I've spent a lot of other people's money.
I know that feeling. So just talk about the book and how did that start? How did that come about?
It sort of, I mean, the collection, you know, directly fed this idea of like posting daily on Instagram to just share the stuff, because so much of the stuff is hard to find and there's so much cool art inside. So I was posting daily on Vintage RPG, and it always felt like the posts were some sort of shorthand or notes for something bigger. And then Ed Park, who recently wrote the novel Same Bed, Different Dreams, he was following me. I had no idea who he was. He was just some guy. And now he's a Pulitzer Prize nominee. But he was just like, Stu, you should write a book. And I was just like, yeah, sure. He's like, no, I'll get you an agent. You know, like I'll introduce you to an agent and see what happens. It didn't work out with the agent, but that was a learning process. And then I have this terrible thing where I just can't work with people. Especially in publishing, they work at a pace far slower than I'm used to. I worked at the Daily News for a long time, so I was used to daily cycles of stuff. So I'm just at a pace. I like to make a thing and then, you know, immediately put it out there. So the publishing world is, you know, not like that. So I kind of just went rogue and found a way to like get MIT. My editor at MIT was in my Call of Cthulhu game at the time. So I sort of browbeat him until he handed over the production capabilities to me, and we just pushed this book out.
MIT seemed quite committed to producing archives of material. They've supported John Peterson stuff, haven't they? Is that a policy they've got? Or have they identified this as a publishing genre that has got an audience?
I do think, I mean, John is also on my editor Noah's list. So yeah, I think that Noah has really, I think that it was, he identified it as an underserved segment of the larger gaming crit world. And he's just been looking for ways to crack it open. It's really gratifying for him to have given me the opportunity to do a book like mine, which is not really an academic book in the same way as sort of John's stuff is, and still put it, you know, on the same shelf next to John's. I think that it's a really good 1-2 punch.
Yeah, because like the podcast, it reflects on these things as a personal response. It's not necessarily an authoritative voice, is it? It's a curious voice wanting to discover new things about these games.
Yeah, and I mean, this sort of segues into the thing you were mentioning on the podcast a few weeks ago when you were sort of like what I said at the Areas of Effect Symposium, where it's just these role-play games can't, I just don't feel like they could be adequately analyzed because there's some an intrinsic sort of variety to it between the games, between how the games are played, you know, how it changes with who's at the table. And I think that that's sort of a similar thing. I came at the book as like, this is like really just my experience. And I think that in a weird way, I think that everybody's experience is different, but I think the fact that like, I just went into it as it being my experience sort of made it resonate in a really sort of personal way with everybody. The reaction's been interesting, but in that regard, but I do think that it's just, I don't think that there's, it's, I just think it's really hard to talk about role-playing games in anything other than a personal context. Like it's always going to veer towards memoir.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not necessarily a nostalgia, because I always say that I'm having more fun playing games now than I ever did.
Mm-hmm.
But there is some latent nostalgia that you tap into, isn't there? That's the nature of fantasy and imagination anyway, yeah. Isn't it?
And old stuff. I mean, it's such an established aesthetic, I think, in some ways, that it's hard to sort of wrestle with it in a non-nostalgic way. You have to acknowledge that nostalgia is a component, at the very least. I don't tend to be nostalgic, I don't think, overall. Like, I'm constantly reevaluating my opinion on things because my opinion's constantly changing, and I don't think that, I don't know. I think that nostalgia is, it's easy to slip into nostalgia for nostalgia's sake, but if you do, I think that you're missing out on the real beauty of the whole hobby and how much it's changed and continues to change and is constantly reevaluating itself. You know, the OSR is like, it is nostalgia, but it's also pushed that style of play in such weird and different, you know, directions that were not at all possible in the golden era of like 74 to 84, you know?
Yeah. And I also think you do a good job of injecting the personal, but also giving a sense of the convoluted tales of some of these publications, because that is part of the attractiveness of listening to the stories, isn't it? Because these very small companies had personalities around them that affected the publications that they produced.
Oh, absolutely. And just the, like, such huge personalities married to such small companies, like even the biggest of them, you know, TSR back in the day was big, but it's not like it is now, or it's like, you know, Wizards of the Coast is a giant organ of a larger corporation, but like all these small, like just small companies doing weird stuff and like just injecting so much of their own interests into the game. They're almost all the games in the early eras feel so semi-autobiographical. You know, like there's so much of Greg Stafford and Gary Gygax and Dave Arneson just like baked into the decisions that they made in the mechanically. Like Gygax is so obvious. Like the Dungeon Master's Guide is just such a mess, but like such a clear glimpse into his brain. And it's just, and I think that's the fun of, you know, looking at the big picture of the hobby is sort of marveling at all the different threads and how it comes together and picking at them and following them and seeing how, where they lead. And they almost always lead to strange and surprising places.
It's the people who collaborate, isn't it? So, and I was recently reading your entry about Hearn and the artists that came together and coalesced to produce that. Created a unique product just by the very nature that they were together.
Yeah, it's just, and then, and that's a great example of just how strange these things get, because there's two Harns, right? Like after Crosby, I'm not sure what his name is off the top of my head, but there was a schism between him and his publishing company. They both sort of held rights to it. And now his daughter is producing, you know, stuff separately from Columbia Games. And it's just, how did that happen? And how, like, that's just like an irrational thing in, you know, the way that businesses work these days, where everything's just like so rigidly controlled with their IP law and whatnot. It's just like, how did we come to have two separate horns and have everybody be okay with it? It's very, I love it.
And each version having its own fans and pursuing it in different directions.
Right. Yeah. And it permutates and, you know, the longer it lasts and the more people who interact with it, it gets stranger and keeps growing.
How much of a sense did you have of UK role-playing games before you started this project?
Yeah, I'm sort of endlessly fascinated with the UK scene, just because it's inherited in a way, because so much of it is filtered through Games Workshop's sort of import of American games that were then, you know, Britishized, and as an American, there's such a sharp contrast between, you know, US and English UK fantasy art. You guys have, like, it's so rooted in 2000 AD and like this interesting sort of really grisly but comical, cartoonish, but not it's hard. I've always had a hard time kind of putting my finger on exactly what, and it's brightly colored if it's in color. There's just something really specific about that that I think for me is the real differentiator. You can see it in the UK products for D&D, and you can see it. It's just it, and yeah, you've gone in different directions that are interesting, but also I feel like just like fundamentally unknowable to me. I have such like an outsider fascination with UK culture. Like, I have so many books on, my grandparents came from Scotland, and there's just, the whole town was very Scottish. So there's just growing up, there was always sort of a touch of Scotland and everything. And I have, you know, books on standing stones, and it's just like an endless, I've been reading like Alan Garner's books for the last 2 years, trying to get through all of his stuff. I've just like become like this outsider who's deeply fascinated with the UK, but always like realizing that like I'm never going to quite understand it as in the way that I could have if I had lived there, you know.
I like the moment when in your description of Warhammer Fantasy Roleplaying and the Enemy Within, mm-hmm. and yeah. You note of its obsession with taxation in a similar vein to the Phantom Menace.
Yeah, that's definitely not something that would happen in American games.
In this episode of the Grognard Files, we've been exploring different magic systems and thinking about what makes a good magic system. It'd be interesting your input on that, and having had this breadth of experience of the different systems, what would you go for? What is it that you look for when it comes to magic?
I like magic that either serves a really strong narrative function, like it does in Call of Cthulhu, or I like magic that functions similarly to early D&D, where you have this really elaborate system of simulation that is so rooted in realism, and then the magic system comes along and just smashes it through its own ridiculous sets of rules. I love the fact that D&D magic is sort of grounds for legal battle. Just even, you know, the least lawyerly of players have hopes and dreams about how a given spell should be interpreted at any given moment, always to their own advantage. And I just think that sort of that appeals to me in some perverse way, because I think it's really brilliant, and it really cuts against sort of everything else that is you know, mechanical about D&D is this sort of war gamer simulation, and then magic just messes it all up. It's great.
Say a little bit more about the narrative function of magic in Call of Cthulhu.
I like how there's So A, unlike D&D, in Call of Cthulhu, characters have no real firm grip on what a spell does. Honestly, you should be renaming your spells so that, you know, they match the books that they get out of. It's hard to learn spells. If you do cast a spell or learn a spell, it costs you, you know, sanity and damages the effectiveness of your character. But you often have to engage in, you know, these occult practices in order to be successful. So it helps push that sort of caustic relationship between the plot and like you know, in Call of Cthulhu, your characters are meant to be sort of destroyed over time. So magic is a big way of doing that. And then because the players don't have this sort of law book version of magic, you as the game master can sort of apply that magic in any way that you see fit in service of the narrative. So like they might be thinking that they're summoning a certain type of monster, you know, conjuring a certain kind of effect. And then you can decide to change that to the benefits of the drama of the situation. You know,
when we talked about it, we explained it in terms of slow magic and fast magic. So this idea that some of it is utilitarian, some of it is just has a narrative appeal but takes over time and has consequences. And that games are constantly in a kind of conflict between the two, the slow and fast magic.
Yeah, I like that. And then you have RuneQuest that sort of has like six different magic systems and that are all sorts of variants of that. That's interesting. Yeah.
What experience have you got of Ars Magica? Because it's a game that we've never played.
Me neither. My comic book guy, the fellow who ran the local comic book store when I was in high school, was a fan of Ars Magica. I don't know how he played it, or if he even played it. He definitely read the book. I can't picture him or anybody that I knew playing in the troop style. But I mean, I think it's more handleable than Mage: The Ascension, which I just don't understand how anybody could run that game. Playing it seems doable, but running, I don't know. And I guess to a certain extent, I think that carries over to ours. I think that it's just with freeform systems like that, I personally have trouble. Because I came up, I think, with Dungeons and Dragons with its rigid rule structures. It's like I'm standing at a great height without any guardrails. I freeze up and I don't know what to do. And my brain, I can't imagine. It sounds so much fun, but I can't imagine, like a lot of really interesting games, playing it without the designer running it. You know, I just don't think I'm up to the challenge on either side of the screen, to be honest.
Because I have a massive blind spot with games from the 90s, because I stopped playing, went into a deep freeze during that period of time. But it strikes me, looking at your book and looking at the history of it, that was a time when people went into the idea of magic as opposed to combat. Like it was emergent as the centrality of magic became more important in games that were produced in the 90s. Is that a fair reflection?
Yeah, well, I think that the 90s is just full of this sort of, somebody in my Discord called it Gnostic role-playing games. And it's just everything seems obsessed with this idea of there being multiple levels of reality and sort of finding ways to plumb the depths of what that means. And magic just seems like a more effective tool than kind of, you know, physical combat of the 70s and 80s. But at the same time, and I guess Call of Cthulhu sort of sets a certain template for that kind of play, because most of these games see you as you interact more with the unnatural, you know, it damages you in some way. I find that a lot of these games, despite their sort of intent, wind up being sort of more D&D than you might expect. It plays out a little bit differently because it's magic, but it's still the systems, the way they interact and the results sort of feel the same to me. It's just sort of in an angstier, more metaphysical candy coating.
So that's an interesting interpretation, that idea that it was a period of transgression, but actually, in a way, they're quite conservative.
Well, I mean, it's the same thing as why are so many board games sort of arranged around, you know, colonial, you know, methods of extraction and warfare. It's just because there's something appealing about those mechanics that just works really well in a game. And I think that there's sort of something similar going on with I think that there's sort of in application, it is unusual for games to be sort of outside of that initial template. I think that initial template has a heavy gravity that pulls games back into it, even when they are pushing to be different, interesting, or reconfiguring the norms of play. I think that it's like trying to get out of a black hole. You're always going to, there's just going to be like a hint of D&D in everything for a variety of reasons. But I think it's hard to escape unless you go really, really far. Like the narrative story games are so far out. That's one of the reasons why that I feel uncomfortable playing those, because it doesn't have that rigidity. Whereas like something like Ars, I could maybe figure out, or maybe not Ars, but like Cult, I could play like Unknown Armies, which is very Call of Cthulhu, or even Call of Cthulhu, which I think of as a more narrative focused game, is very crunchy. People have that skill system is very overwhelming for people who've never played games before, role-playing games. So I think that even though, you know, I think that Call of Cthulhu is really different, you know, to an outsider, there's the gap between D&D and Call of Cthulhu is actually much smaller than we realize.
So you're playing games now. So what's on your games list at the moment? What are you currently playing?
I've been all in as much as I can on this West Marches game I've been running. It's been such a hoot. It's very deadly. A lot of things. I've written a bunch of random tables that we've been playing rules as written, old school essentials, and I try to keep it as much rules as written as possible. But I've introduced some new systems to kind of increase the randomness, and I've just really leaned into the idea of random encounters and letting tables make all the decisions for me. And it's not a style of play that I'm really used to. I'm used to more of something like, I've run Masks of Nyarlathotep 3 times now. So like, I like having a framework of narrative to kind of work with, but this doesn't have that at all. It's just, it's exploration and randomness with some light, you know, indications of emergent mystery. And it's just been fantastic. It keeps being extremely rewarding and surprising for everyone. And even though they've become very cynical about the survivability of the game, the pool of players is just like, there's just an industry of self-immolation at work. They're willing to throw themselves into the breach again and again. And it's been fascinating and exciting. I've never played a game quite like this, and I'll have like 12, 13 players in a go it's wild.
We should say about the podcast as well, because there may be some people who haven't discovered it, Grognard Files listeners who haven't discovered it. If you haven't, then you're in for a treat. Just explain what that is and its frequency and what you cover.
It's the we cleverly named it the Vintage RPG Podcast. So it's a real left field name. Every Monday, me and my co-host John Hambone McGuire either interview somebody who's making a game, or I just sort of rattle on about bits and bobs from RPG history, usually, you know, a specific product or game, and try and give as quick and lively a recap of what's appealing about it. They are short episodes. Get a lot of complaints. Why don't you make it longer? It's because I can only think for 20 minutes in a clip. It just falls apart after that. I start rambling. It don't make any sense anymore.
You're doing well. We get complaints. Why are they so long?
The thing is that no one's ever happy. And I just prefer recording short bursts. So that's the way we're going to do it. But yeah, and we have a Patreon that supports it, and the Discord, and it's, you know, a nice little community where we keep it chill.
Yeah, I guess that's one of the rewarding things of this, isn't it? Producing a podcast by accident, you end up creating a community.
Yeah, I didn't even want to do the podcast at first. Tambone was just sort of got interested in like the production side of it. He's like, can we do a podcast? It's like, I don't know. Nobody wants to hear me rattle on about stuff. And Tambone's like, no, it'll be great. Don't worry. And I think we've been doing it 8 years. And I'm just like, man, how did this happen? I have a dedicated microphone stand on my desk. Like, it's.
And in terms of writing, Stu, what a projects have you got up and coming?
So at some point this year, I think in the summer, hopefully, Down, Down, Down will be coming out through Stranger Tractor Press. It's a funny little book. I basically went through 100 or 150 books and legends and mythology and literature, and tried to find things that seemed to me that, older stuff that influenced the creation or the idea of a fantasy dungeon. And then once, you know, D&D happened and the fantasy dungeon, you know, was released into the zeitgeist, things that sort of interplay with it. So it's basically a bunch of quotes from stuff, movies, and then some commentary. So it's not like the last book. It's a smaller book, but it wound up being like really interesting. it's such an odd form that it sort of I find it hard to sort of give a good elevator pitch to. But it wound up being, I think, just sort of amusing on the creation and evolution of the fantasy dungeon, I think would be the easiest way to put it. I think it's something that was on our collective minds for a long time, but it never coalesced until 1974 in the way that it is now. There's lots of, it's very strange to me that there's nothing that you could point at that 100% lines up with the idea of a D&D dungeon. And in our history and our literature, until that point. And then once it happens, it's just such a perfect, like, conceptual thing that also is like a mechanical thing that makes the game like playable in a way that it's both expansive in that, you know, there's really no limit to the size of a dungeon, but the choices that you face at any given point are limited. It's, you know, two corridors, three doors, or whatever. And I think, and all of that just sort of comes together, and it just becomes this fantastic mind place. That's just, I think that more than anything, I think that that's the, and it leaps fully formed from 74 D&D. It really is the greatest thing that, Gygax and Arneson really created. I just, everybody's like, well, they created role-playing games. It's like, yeah, but I think the dungeon is a bigger deal. It just, because it spills over, right? And it's like everywhere now. You can see it in movies and in novels. It's just like the idea of that space, that mythic space, is just, it's intoxicating. It changed something about how we perceive, the underworld. It's cool.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to that, Stu. And thank you very much for spending this time with us. It's been great.
Oh, absolutely. Any time. I'm happy to come on and ramble along.
Place Day giveaway. Welcome to the Room of Roleplaying Rambling. We're in the attic. It's a bit cold up here. There's a draft. The pigeon is shivering as it looks through its one eye, tapping on the window. And I've got Blythe with me. Hello, Blythe.
Hello, Dirk.
Sorry, I stopped you from your brew.
You stopped me from slurping my brew.
Yeah, but yeah. Anyway, it's Fish Eve. Eve Fish.
Well, Fish Eve.
I don't think it's not in the normal calendar, but it's our.
But we're going to see the great man, aren't we?
Going to see Derek Dick.
Derek W. Dick. I wonder if he called himself Fish.
Yeah, lead singer of Marillion. He's doing a farewell tour.
Another one.
Yeah, but pretty sure we'd be to another one.
Yeah, yeah, he'll do another.
Yeah. He's off being a croster up in the Highlands somewhere. And so this is his final concert. We're going tomorrow with Eddie. Bit of an Armchair Adventures reunion. I've not really listened to much of his stuff.
I've been listening to his solo work in a diligent fashion, so that I'm not stood there in the crowd thinking, what are these? What are these songs? Six of Marillion. Sing Kayleigh. Come on. I think he does sing Kayleigh as an encore, but I think predominantly it's his solo work.
Which is okay if you like that kind of thing. It's a bit like Marillion, as in 80s Marillion, proper Marillion, not this new stuff. Do you think with the nickname Fish, is it one of those nicknames that he's given himself? Somebody pointed out that people don't give nice nicknames, and it's like Sting saying,
oh yeah, they used to call me Sting because of a jumper that I got.
No, they didn't. You decided you wanted to be called Sting.
You decided that because it sounded good as a rock star.
And I think Fish's story was that he used to spend a long time in the bath.
Yeah, his landlady called him Fish because he spent too much time in the bath or something.
Yeah. And usually, nicknames are slightly insulting, aren't they?
Yeah, they're a mickey tail. I suppose it's a mickey tail, though, isn't it? Spends too much time in the bath, so it's called Fish.
I don't buy it.
No, probably not.
What was your nickname at school?
Blythe.
Yeah, and it's kept with you ever
and
since.
And it's stuck. Yeah. There you go. That's not particularly insulting.
I had the Hair Bear Bunch. It was all to do with my hair.
Tom Baker.
Tom Baker was the other.
Got Tom Baker all point.
Anyway, enough of that. It's tomorrow, Friday. Good to have Fish on a Friday, they say, don't they? But we've got this segment now. It's a big topic. I've called this Stay, Play, Giveaway. So this is normally Snog, Marry, Avoid.
Yes.
For games. Stay, Blythe.
Blythe, use the nickname.
I struggled. And I'll tell you why I struggled. I don't think I've found a magic system that I've looked at and thought, yeah, this does it for me. This is the thing that captures the essence, what I like about magic. I think it's like a holy grail. It is yet to be found. That makes
you should have called this section Hobnobs and Broomsticks. It's not magic. There you go.
Hobnobs and Broomsticks. I'm having that.
I do know what you mean. And I think there's a reason for that is because In a weird way, you once said this very podcast that you always looked at the bestries, the monsters in a game to give you a feel of what the game was like.
Yeah.
Well, I always look at the magic system because I think the magic systems always give you a clue about what the game is about. In a weird way, that's why I think you're never going to find that holy grail, because magic systems generally, I think, are linked and tied into what the style of the game. They seem to be somehow integral to the way the game is. So it's like one of my favourite magic systems is the DCC magic. Quite crazy. Roll on tables. Almost like anything can happen or nothing can happen. There's all sorts of side effects to spells and stipulations when you cast them. But that's in keeping with DCC, isn't it? You couldn't take that magic system out of that game and drop it into, I don't know, RuneQuest, because it wouldn't fit, would it? And I think that's the thing with magic systems. If they're a good magic system, it tends to complement the style of game. So DCC is quite gonzo.
I get what you're saying then. So the magic system is both integral to the setting, so what the expectations of the game world is.
Mm,
so
yeah,
it gives you an idea of that, but also what it's like to play.
It's the style of game that it is. So you look at 5th edition, don't you? And I mean, you look at D&D generally, if you look at advanced D&D, the magic system in advanced D&D, which I have a kind of fondness for, it's quite detailed. But if you look at 5th edition, the spells in 5th edition, although they are the same spells to by and large, they're incredibly like detailed. It can do it for so many rounds, and then this happens. If you save, that happens. If this happens, it's a D4. If this happens, it's a D6. So, but that is in keeping with 5th edition, isn't it? Because it's a very tactical game system. Savage Worlds is similar. If you look at Savage Worlds' magic system, I'd say it's a bit bland, but it's quite tactical. It kind of fits, and that's why it's difficult to pick a particular magic system.
Yeah, and I always think that when we do these, there's a bit of recency bias because it's what we're playing at the moment. I'm playing a magic user in DCC Lankmar.
You are.
And I'm not that keen on it because I feel that the uncertainty of it and the amount of energy and personal characteristic investment that you have to do to make sure that something effective happens.
Yeah.
To me, the cost is too high for what could be a disappointing result.
Yeah. I can see that, it can be a bit frustrating. You have to be sort of... It's an odd thing, isn't it? Because when you read DCC... Initially, you see you roll on the spell table and think, oh, you don't lose your spells like D&D. You can keep your spells. You might lose them if you roll badly, but you can potentially keep your spell. But you're right, you have to be quite tactical and think, do I want to risk losing this? Or do I want to put resources in terms of my spell burn statistics into it to make sure it works? And once you do that, you realize in some ways you can only cast it once or twice. Because you're going to fail, aren't you?
But the reason why I like playing spellcasters is having that ingenuity of coming up with a solution that's only available to you with the ability of magic.
Yeah.
And because the effects vary depending on what you roll, you can't really apply it because you don't know what effect you're going to get in a situation.
Yeah.
So if I want to use a rope spell to get to another level.
Yeah.
I might cast it at a level where actually all it's doing is entangling people around me.
Yeah. I think sometimes you can knock the spell effect down a bit, can't you? On some spells. Not all spells, but I think some of them on the descriptions, you can choose to pick a lower one if you roll the wrong one.
Yeah.
You see what I mean? If you go like that, if you roll really high and the rope's entangling people, not lifting people, just want it to climb somewhere. I think you can pick a lower one. But it does depend on the spell.
Yeah.
Not all of them.
I think it's that element of unpredictability that...
Yeah.
When I'm playing it, I'm thinking, oh, well, I don't really want that result. But what I think it does do well is obviously the source of magic is an element in games. Where does it come from?
Mm.
And I do like the idea of getting it from patrons. So
you
can explain that. You've got some.
Yeah, you've got like a patron. You can ask them for help, can't you? That kind of thing. And I suppose as well, and this is very unlike me, I do quite like, because let's not forget clerics.
Mm.
Wish we could, but let's not forget them. But in DCC, I quite like the cleric magic system because with things like disapproval. So when you roll to cast a spell, if you fail the roll, you get points of disapproval, which would mount up to the point where the gods are getting annoyed with you for asking for magic all the time and can stop giving it to you for the day. That's quite clever. And it's quite clever because it makes clerics a bit more like a priest.
Yeah.
Whereas in D&D, it's just, you've got some spells, but don't misbehave, otherwise the gods might take them off you. What was that supposed to mean? Whereas in DCC, there's a mechanical thing of disapproval that racks up. Gradually, every time you fail a spell, you get another point of disapproval. Every point of disapproval you get, there's a greater chance the gods will be displeased with you for keep asking for favours.
Yeah.
That kind of works quite nicely. You're hitting the nail on the head there, where this is the thing with it. As an example, it's a magic system that does a particular thing because that's what the game's like. DCC encourages crazy unpredictability, which you'd either like or not like, depending on how it's going for you.
Yeah, I think in the context of the game, it's enjoyable. I just feel because, as I say, being the magic user, all that you can really bring to the table is ingenious use of your spell
yeah.
book.
Yeah.
And there needs to be some element of predictability about that. Now, what I was going to put forward to my play is something that I'm getting my head around now, which is desanction, which we had Paul on the previous episode. And that's what's encouraged me to look to that. Now, what that uses is words to describe what the magic might enable, but just a word. And you, as a player and game moderator, have to negotiate if that actual solution that you've come up with that particular word, like if it's dig, for example, that how big the hole might be that you dig.
Yeah.
So that's another approach to magic, isn't it? You've got the very specific table responses. Mm. And these are your spells, this is what they do. Or you have this other approach, which is this is a description. You apply that to how you to the situation that you're approaching. Which do you prefer?
I don't think I prefer one or the other. It makes me think that what you've just said about desanction makes me think there's a game called Nave, which is like a dungeon crawling game. And that has spells in it, which are just a bit like that. They all last 10 minutes or something. So they all last the same amount of time. But all it says as a description is, you can turn someone else or yourself invisible. You can climb the walls like a spider. You can walk through objects. Just all it has is a sentence. That's all it says.
Yeah.
And that is quite appealing because, as you said, it gives a bit of license and a bit of freedom to interpret what you want. That said, though, it's a game where there's no classes. So people can acquire spells, but you're probably not going to acquire many spells. Think something like DCC. Wizards end up getting lots of spells. So one of the difficulties is, if it's a game where people have lots of spells, the more of a need maybe to regulate those spells, because otherwise it's like a crazy free-for-all and can upset maybe other character classes or other players who are a bit more beholden to the rules. So it's a simple example. If you're the character who hits things with a sword, you're going to have to roll a certain number, aren't you, to hit things. If you're a wizard who's got a load of spells that are just words, it's all negotiation, isn't it? It's all right if you've just got a few spells. And I imagine the desanction's a bit like that.
Yeah.
The magic's not. Yeah, and that name's a bit like that. You don't end up with 10, 15 spells. That's always the problem, isn't it? The wizards has a lot of power, but it's how do you regulate that power in a game world? So the two ways you do it is you have certain stipulations about what the spell does. And the other way you do it is the cost that magic has on the character. What do you have to give up to have magic? Or what does it cost you? Because if you just give everyone magic...
We might come back to that, I think.
Mm, yeah.
Because that is to do with game balancing, isn't it?
Yeah.
And understanding what are the costs to you personally. Desanction. And what I'm enjoying about reading that and getting into it is understanding the world's attitude towards magic and the emergence of magic and the emergence of the unraveling, as it's described, the emergence of spirits and monsters that were long subdued, says something about the setting regulated. It's unusual. It's a quirk in the world that's the thing that makes adventuring exciting, because you have the ability to manipulate things in the way that others don't.
Yeah.
Well, you've got those high-powered ones. Those are power fantasies, aren't they, in D&D and in DCC. I don't think there's enough, because they are Gonzo worlds, of what impact having people with that level of magic has on how things are done.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. And my gripe about the D&D world is it's a ludicrous setting because there's magic everywhere. Everyone, every other person you meet, the bus stop's a wizard, and you think this world couldn't exist, could it really?
Well, it's a bit like the current real world unpleasantness that we're not going to dwell on.
No.
So I'm just going to mention this because Terry Pratchett kind of makes this analogy. What's happening in the world at the moment is regulated by the fact that nuclear weapons exist.
Mm.
The world in which magic exists.
Yeah.
A set of context, wouldn't it? Would wars actually happen, or would wars have a different complexion, would monsters antagonists have to adapt and change?
Well, it's like we've said once before. Would it be a pseudo-medieval world if magic was so prevalent? It wouldn't necessarily look the same, would it? And I think it's interesting when you pick on, you mentioned earlier, we're playing DCC Lankmar. What's interesting about that Lankmar setting, the people who wrote it have toned magic down.
Yes.
So magic, there's very few magic items. There's not as many wizards or sorcerers as you think. So it's all toned down. And why is it toned down? Well, it's partly toned down because in Fritz Lieber's stories, it's toned down. But it's also toned down because it's in a city. And for a city to function in a recognisable way, you can't have magic everywhere. Because that was my gripe about Dragon Heist, Waterdeep. It was ludicrous. It was a ludicrous setting where you had magicians everywhere. It was just preposterous. DCC proper is a gonzo game where you go down crazy dungeons. It doesn't care too much about the world building. But when you get to Lankmar, it's toned down the magic. And when you read the Dying Earth supplement, they altered magic in that as well. So it's like there is that thing. Once you start getting into world building or a world, that influences your magic system.
Yeah.
For better or worse, because it has to.
And perhaps with the D-Sanction being set in a version of our own world.
Exactly.
That gives it a completely different complexion.
It gives it a complexion because you can't have a magic system like 5th edition D&D in the D-Sanction because it's set in Elizabethan Britain. So it's got to be subtle, hasn't it?
So what we're saying then in our
play... I don't know.
Well, what we're saying is because it needs to be integrated into the world.
I think that's the thing. It needs to fit the world, and also the world needs to fit it. I think it cuts both ways. It's the magic system complements the game, maybe the world, but also the game style. And the other way around as well. They both influence each other.
Yeah.
Like I said, I don't think you could drop you couldn't drop the DCC magic system into the D-Sanction, could you?
No.
It'd be ludicrous, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Because people would say, oh, it's a Elizabethan Britain. But don't worry. You know, when you cast a spell, you roll on this crazy table and anything can happen. And you think, what? That wouldn't fit, would it?
No.
But equally, if you took the D-Sanction game and put it in DCC, that wouldn't work.
So what were you going to propose as your stay?
My stay was going to be Helvesia.
Right, I've got a big button here that says recency bias. So I'm going to hit that again.
Well, you're always saying that, but, you know, we've played some of these games for a long time. I mean, I was a bit torn because I did think about Call of Cthulhu because I think Call of Cthulhu magic's good as well.
Yeah.
And again, it's a very fine example, actually. Possibly the finest example that if you pick up the rule book and read the spells in Call of Cthulhu, you will understand what that game's about because those spells drive you mad and do horrible things to people. So you can read it and go, oh, I see. So if you're going to mess around with magic and the power of Cthulhu, you're in trouble.
Helvesia and Call of Cthulhu have something in common in that magic comes at a cost.
It does come at a cost.
A personal cost.
Personal cost, yeah. Well, I think what I like about Helvesia, I don't think I've played a game that's done this, actually. That's why I picked it, because it does something. You might be recency biased, but at the same time, it does something that I don't think any game I've played has done, in that magic is gained or lost through your behaviour as a character, potentially. So to be a student of the black arts, but your virtue has to be either in the low bracket or the middle bracket to use your magic. You've got to keep etiquette, stay friends with the devil to use black magic. In the same way that if you're a priest, your virtue's got to be in the middle bracket or the higher bracket. And things you do in the game will gain or lose your virtue. If you're a student of the black arts, can't be too good because the devil won't give you the spells anymore. So you've got to be a bit mean at times, not give the beggar, steal the beggar's food or swindle the tavern owner. Actions influence how much magic you've got or whether you've got magic at all.
A good way of conveying that relationship between who's providing the magic, who is the, what's the source of it? That's the element of magic that I find fascinating in game worlds. This is my stare. It's been on the shelf for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Dragon Quest and the way that it tries to describe magic in the world. So it's like, as we said before, go back to the episode if you want to get it in more detail. It's an implied setting. Magic comes in different forms. It's delivered by different schools, different arcane schools, but also through negotiation with demons and devils.
Yeah.
So some of them come at a cost that you have to bargain for. And so I like that implication, a bit like you're saying, it's that payoff that I think on the Discord, somebody described it as like fast magic and slow magic. The idea that some things come to your aid immediately to fix current situation.
Yeah. Mm.
However, what Dragon Quest has, a part of it tries to explain is there's also slow magic, ritual magic, stuff that can get you stuff that is a bit more significant. That might not help you in the moment, but it might help you longer projects that you want to do as a magician. But is that compatible with being a player character? And I think that's what Alvesia does quite well, is that that bargaining between virtue and vice.
Virtue and vice.
I can't know what it is.
It's just a virtue, isn't it? So it's a very low or high virtue.
So the virtue scale is a good way of representing that in the moment for a player character.
But it's, like I say, it's interesting how, in a lot of games, the things you do, let's say go back to the clerics in D&D, behave, otherwise, you know, the gods will take things off you. It's just, that's a vague idea. And even in DCC, the disapproval thing is just a mechanical thing of you failed spell roll, your disapproval goes up. But in Helvesia, there's it's actual actions. So if you go around being too nice, you're going to not be able to cast your black magic spells. That's kind of quite unusual. There may be other games that do it, but I don't think I've ever played one that does that.
No.
Where your actual in-game actions, you've got to keep looking over your shoulder thinking, I'm gone, being a bit too good here. Or in the priest case, I'm not being good enough. I'm being a bit cowardly, or I'm drinking too much, or whatever, you know.
What are you going to give away?
I think the thing I would give away is probably Conan 2D20 magic, because I have played a sorcerer, a witch in that. I did find it quite satisfying. It's almost like it's not, magic's not for players in Conan, which again is in keeping with the books, because sorcerers tend to be the baddies, don't they? I mean, you don't, you know.
Yeah.
And I did feel like that. I think I had some spells. I don't think I ever used any of them because the cost was too high and they weren't that impressive at lower levels. They weren't, you know, I think I had something with shape changing, but it was like you couldn't really do much with it. You might go mad. You thought, well, fucking heck. It was a bit like you were saying, as a player, you think, well, I want to, if I'm a witch or sorcerer, I want to be able to do something. And so it feels like it would have been better if they just said, look, in keeping with the Conan stories, sorcery is for NPCs. And you could then just simplify the whole thing, because Vaesen does that with some of the powers that the Vaesen have. It just says they can do stuff.
Yeah. So how do you feel about that then? Because there are strong feelings, aren't there, whether there needs to be parity between NPCs and PCs. So NPCs, should they be allowed to have access to greater powers than the PCs?
At the end, though, it depends on the world. My point with Conan is, if you're playing Conan, if you look at the Conan stories, the sorcerers tend to be the baddies, slightly mad. That in that game, maybe it seems fair enough. If it's D&D, the player can be a 20th level wizard and you can be fighting a 20th level wizard. So that seems fair, that the 20th level NPC wizard is still bound by the same rules, because that's the game. In other games, it's not quite like that, is it? So in Vaesen, for example, you investigate the Vaesen. You don't play them. So them having weird powers, like being able to make it rain frogs or create fog or something like that, it seems fine because, well, you're not playing them. You're investigating them. You're dealing with them. And Conan, I think, sits a bit like that. don't be a sorcerer. Because the magic system in Conan is okay in as much as it does sort of give the same, it gives the same feeling that you get in the books, doesn't it? That sorcery is dangerous and there's a real price to pay and only crazy people pursue it because it's dangerous and all that. That is all in the rule, but does that quite well. But as a player, when I was playing a witch, I felt, it's just not fun, this. Everyone else is wielding the broadsword and hacking heads off, and I'm sitting in a corner thinking, well, I've got this shape-changing spell, but I don't think I can really cast it.
I've tried to create parity with the NPCs and the players, but there's also this idea of, should the magic system be consistent with the core system, or should it be a subsystem that behaves in a different way? I think part of the problem with Conan, because you're giving abilities to people that they're going to activate, and you're dependent on getting momentum and getting your dice and getting the score. At the end of the day, you can get better results by using the sword and using all the... They've tried to make the mechanics for hitting things the same as casting spells.
Yeah, yeah. Try to give it a... It's the same core system being used for everything.
Whereas I think it's better if it breaks. It's better if magic is a disruptive and it behaves differently from the rest of the game.
Some games do that, I suppose, don't they? There's nothing wrong with doing that. By giving it as a, like say, a subsystem of this is how it works. Savage Worlds sort of does that a bit because it has the power points, doesn't it?
It does.
Power points don't really come into it unless you've got. So if you're a character without magic, if you're doing fantasy Savage Worlds, for example, because it could be psionics, could be anything, couldn't it? But it's fantasy. Your power point thing doesn't come into it unless you use magic. If you don't use magic, you don't have to worry about power points and how they're replenished. It's a separate. It sits slightly outside the main core system, doesn't it? Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that.
Because what I want to give away, and this is a big chunk of my shelf, is rules with spell lists. Magic, it ends up being more like an accountancy challenge. Yeah. Trying to work out, okay, so those tactical games, it is part of it, isn't it? You're trying to make sure that you're getting the points and your distribution of the points and you're getting the dice rolls. Well, that's not magic, is it? That's just firepower or, you know,
it's not magic, but then again, hitting someone with a sword in role-playing games, not hitting someone with a sword, is it? I mean, it never...
Yeah, but you've chosen...
You could argue that when you hit someone with a broadsword hard enough, they don't just lose some hit points. It's probably going to shock.
Magic should be magical.
I know what you mean. I do know what you mean. But I think the problem that we're kind of zeroing in on here is it's a game. Controlling it at a table, as in everyone knows what can happen, what they can do. And I agree, that sort of takes magic out of the magic.
So for example, if I wanted to create a puddle gate, right?
Mm.
So I wanted to create a puddle in the ground so I could jump into it and emerge a puddle somewhere else.
Yeah.
Right. What's better? For that to be a spell listed, or should it be gates in general? You've got a spell that is gates and you can have that as a general word.
Yeah, yeah.
Or do you just say, well, as a magic user, if you can come up with something in your environment and just explain it.
Yeah. You can do that. But as I said earlier, I think the problem with it is it depends on what the other players who are not magic users can do or can't do. I think there is that problem of if you're not a magic using character, and you are held by certain rules of the game, certain dice rolls, there's a weird imbalance if the wizard can start to just say stuff. As someone who always plays a wizard, I always want to play the wizard. I'm fine with that. I'd be all right with it. But if it was a games master, I'd sit there thinking, all right, so you lot have all got to roll dice. I will hit him a broadsword. What I'm going to do, I'm going to launch myself at my broadsword. Right, can you roll a 15 or more? 12. Oh, you've missed. What I'm going to do, I'm going to use this spell to create this, that, and the other. Oh, all right. There's a sort of, there's an imbalance. But it depends on the game, I suppose, because if it wasn't a game where the non-magic using people had to roll, if everyone was operating on a similar kind of level, it'd probably be all right. It sounds like a rules lawyer.
Yeah.
But if all the other players are kind of beholden to certain mechanical rules, as they almost always are in these games, let's not make any bones about it. Most games involve rolling dice to do stuff. If everyone's beholden to that, the problem with having a magic system that one of the players has got that's kind of just vague stuff can be, I suppose, potentially problematic. I'm not saying it necessarily is, but could be problematic.
I guess it's that thing of spell lists, and I think as soon as you start introducing spell lists and specific spells, it's very limiting. So you as a player who've got a limited range of what you're able to do in a particular situation, you spend your time just scratching your head thinking, well, how can I make this work in this situation?
But then again,
in the ways that are defined in this particular
way. I think that's possibly the difference between us, because as a player, I love that. I love being a wizard who's got six spells. One of them is ventriloquism, that you think, what use is that? And then managing to use that within its rules, in an inventive way. I think that's one of the pleasures for me of role-playing, you see. That's why I love being a wizard. I like that idea that give me 10 useless spells and let me make them useful in a dungeon. And everyone, and it's like, oh, great, that really works.
And I like that bit of it, but the way that you've described it there is you're just like a jigsaw puzzle maker who finds a piece that fits into the thing.
Not really. I think it's part of the fun of one of the fun things role playing for me is the kind of puzzle solving. I think I've said this before. One of the fun things in role play for me is the get out of that kind of thing where you as a player you're in a situation where you've got your resources, you're in a tight spot, you've got to get out of it. And being a wizard is great because you can do more than just hit things, but there are certain limitations on what you can do. But the trick is to do stuff within those limitations is the interesting thing for me about magic.
And I don't think I disagree with you necessarily. What I'm opposed to is the convoluted over explanation. It's similar to what you're saying with Conan, because I think that's what their problem is that it's so limited.
I do agree with you on that. And I think that's one of my gripes about fifth edition, because as I said right at the beginning, fifth edition, the spells are so convoluted to the point where what they've done is they've looked at these spells and it's almost like people have been using these spells for the last 30, 40 years, which I suppose they have. And what they've done is try to just put stipulations and qualifications and contingent things in it. So, well, you can polymorph once a day, but only to a creature of the size of whatever. And it's only a creature you've seen. And therefore, when this happens, you get 20% of your hit points back and blah, 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 blah. It goes on and on and on and on. And I agree with you. That is overkill. So, the biggest culprit of it is fifth edition. And I don't particularly like playing a wizard in fifth for that reason, because the spells just go on forever, some of them, about what you can do.
Yeah, and you can end up with a lot of them, and is that trying to find a jigsaw piece?
Yeah, I agree with that. You can go too far, but there's a balance to be, there's a balance, like all these things, there's a balance struck between a fifth edition 7-paragraph description of a spell, which nobody wants, and maybe a word. I can see why, but a word would work in the D sanction. And I suppose coming back to that point, it would work in certain games, but I don't think it would work in all games.
But I all I'm saying is that I think a bit like in the games that have endless lists of skills that are very specific. You know, dental plumbing.
Yeah.
But you could just have water as a word. And within that water, you can have a whole range of what you do. And then you can have a scale to make it harder. I try to do it with BRP and my homebrew of trying to say, well, you could allocate points to this spell. The more points you give to it.
And that's okay. Like say, if you said you had the word water and then you had some kind of rolls to make.
And I suppose I've not explained myself well. I think you need to have that. What I'm against is it's two things I'm against. The reason why I'm taking the spell books off my shelf is those really detailed spells for specific circumstances and situations. And the other bit is the endless lore that explains reasons why they exist and why you get them from your gods and the kind of... those are the things that I just think that is... people just go hog wild when it comes to magic and filling up books with that stuff. Yeah. Whereas I think the spontaneous, the inventive, the encouraging players to come up with something creative is what spells should do.
Yeah. And that's always one of the weird things about spell lists as well. It's they're always quite funny because... there's a spell for shooting a fireball at people. There's a spell for summoning the dead. There's a spell for this, a spell for... there's never one for doing the washing up.
Yeah, we've said that before.
Well, surely you would... yeah. There would be some basic stuff there as well. I mean, if you've got magic, why are you doing the housework?
Yeah.
Go on. Oh, the wizard, I've got to clean the house. But if a Balrog appears, don't worry, I can petrify him. That's not a problem. But making the beds in the morning, flipping out.
Yeah, we said that before, didn't we, when we talked about D&D? But that's the reason why I get rid of all the spell books on thing and just have water. And then I can wash the dishes and drown a bell.
And as we speak, someone's writing now, unseen servant. Yeah, all right. I know, unseen servant. He can make your beds for you. I know, but you take the point. And I suppose, like you say, it's weird with those 5th edition descriptions. You think, this is magic. Where's all these stipulations coming from? What makes it that you can only do it?
But then,
what makes it that it's only so many dice?
Well, then you get to your first thing about talk about the context of the game.
Yeah,
that's when people go overboard and the game designers and people to say this is where it comes from.
Yeah. This is why
this behaves in this particular. I don't care.
Don't care about that. Yeah.
I'm coming away from this conversation
none the wiser.
None the wiser.
Good.
And also with that sense of dissatisfaction that I always have when it comes to magic and role-playing games.
Yeah. But I don't have a dissatisfaction with that. But I just think it's... you've got to understand the game as a whole to enjoy the magic system. That's the thing, isn't it? So, as I said, for me, 5th edition D&D, I don't really enjoy that magic system. But if I was playing it, I'd probably still play a wizard and think, well, I'll go with this because that is the nature of it. It's the nature of this game. That's what the game's about. It's not really magic. It's just magic mirroring the style of game you're playing.
Yeah.
That's why no magic system sits in isolation. You can pick a magic system in isolation and say, oh, it's really good, or oh, it's terrible. But they don't sit in isolation. They fit within the game world. I don't even think it's necessarily the game world. I think it's a bit more subtle than that. I think it's the style of game that you're playing.
Last year we put out the call, didn't we, to for games that we haven't been exposed to. And there are games out there that people say this captures magic really well.
Ars Magica
is the one that people usually point to. Yeah. You're playing wizards.
Yes.
And part of a troop of players that are supporting that wizard as they're living their life. I'd like to see that.
Yeah, that would be good to play. Yeah. Because that's it, isn't it? We had a big discussion about magic. We've not played that, which is all about magic. Yeah.
But it's tackled so often in games, but all in the same way. And that's why when I started this off, I found it hard looking at my shelves and saying, what do I want to play? What do I want to stay? What do I want to give away? When the whole thing dissatisfies me. But I like playing magic users.
And I like playing magic users because I always take the view that if you're playing a fantasy game that has magic, why would you not want to be a wizard?
And I'd say as well that I'm quite good at playing magic users.
Yeah.
I'm wanting some confirmation here.
Yeah. That's the false modesty spell.
Yeah.
Why would you not want magic? in a world where there's magic. Why would you want to be a character that doesn't can't do any magic?
Another podcast, The Good Friends of Jackson Hollis, in the early days, they used to make fun of a Call of Cthulhu spell, a track fish.
A track fish. Oh, does that mean you can get his autograph on Friday? Cast it. And he'd rush out to the backstage and sign your old Marillion album.
Derek! Will you sign this for me?
Mr. Dick, will you sign this for me? That's not a track fish. Don't call him Mr. Dick. Don't do that.
Cheers, Blighted.
Goodbye.
This is Bud from Bud's RPG Review, a YouTube channel where I review role-playing games, card games and board games, although if I'm honest, far less of the last two. I do in-depth video reviews of gaming products, all shot from the perspective of just my hands and whatever it is I am talking about. I cover mainstream things like D&D, Call of Cthulhu and Warhammer, as well as out-of-print and hard-to-get-hold-of material, and I take pride in always being thorough and fair. Additionally, I have a smaller sister channel, Bud Zine Review, where I take a more loose look at shorter material like zines, fanzines and mini-scenarios, with the aim being to do it in under 10 minutes, something I've managed to stick to so far. So if you have the time and the hankering for a fair review in my dulcet Scouse tones, then hope to see you there sometime soon. Bud out.
There isn't another bit.
Thanks to Stu for spending time with us. The book is really recommended. Colourful and illuminating. You can get monsters, aliens and holes in the ground in all the usual places. I just want to give a mention to Orlanth Rex's Gaming Vex's recent episode because Steve Ray, the host, has just released an epic about the One Ring role-playing game, which is recommended if you enjoy any aspect of Lord of the Rings role-playing. At the time of recording, we're launching the games for Virtual Grogmeet, which is taking place on the 10th to the 12th of April 2025. You can find out more at thegrognardfiles.com. The Dead Hard Quiz will be brought to you this time by Keith and Scott from the Titterpigs podcast, A Titter Quiz, on Thursday the 10th of April at 8 o'clock. Sign up on Warhorn. The link is in the show notes. You can also sign up for Sunday morning at 11 on the 12th of April to attend a Q&A where I'll be talking to returning guest Steve Brotherston, one of the authors of the fantastic Scarred for Life books. Thanks to the patrons, old and new, who keep this show on the road, paying the bills and encouraging us to continue with the various projects that happen around the pod. Thanks for throwing coins into the beret each month. It's appreciated. With some new people to thank, welcome, and thanks to Billy Bridge, who's come on board with a fancy poof as an honorary member of the Armchair Adventurers Club. At the sofa, so good level, I like to roll from a table to give a virtual gift. This time, I'm looking at the favours, the magical elements that are given to characters in the D Sanction. With the D Sanction, you can roll a dice or use a bloodless deck of cards. I didn't know what a bloodless deck of cards was until I read the D Sanction. Apparently, it's a deck with the royals removed. So, there you go. The first is Bibliopunks. Let's see what magic you can make with this. I'll pick a card. Yes, it's a seven of diamonds. Flurry, cloak, smother, blind. See, you can have more fun with that than a spell in a spell book, can't you? Next up is Chris Went. And you get a six of spades. Drip, trickle, leak, perplex. Next is Michael Burnth. A ten of hearts. Oh, this is a good one. Glower, brood, nightmare, evil eye. Returning supporter is Sid Razavi, who has got a contour rug. You know, one of those little rugs that you might have around the toilet. But you can put it in your armchair, can't you? Look out for his great play reports featured on the Discord channel. Welcome back, Sid. And you've got an ace of clubs, whisper, confidential, hissing, misheard,
unheard. Thanks everyone who listens, shares and reviews. We haven't had a review for a bit, so if you get time, if you could give us one, that'd be great. It passes on the message to others and helps us to find a new audience. So that's another Grog Pod finished. Episode 80 next. And it's the return of First, Last and Everything for a very special guest. Until then, adios, amigos. In the Wonderland Zoo, the way the surgeon there do. Stay at home every night, never quarrel or fight. Ah, we don't even fight. So, no. The bears!